Greetings, friends. I'm John Haspel. This is a recording of our Tuesday evening Dhamma class from Cross River Meditation Center in Frenchtown, New Jersey, on March 13, 2018. This is the week 9 class of our 2018 12-week Dhamma study based on my book, The Truth of Happiness. This week, our study is on understanding not self. If you find benefit from this talk, please consider a donation at becoming-buddha.com. Thank you. Peace.
Religions have many different components and serve different purposes. One of the purposes of religion is to hopefully answer some of the great questions that we have. Where do I come from? Where did all this come from? Who made us? Why? Where do we go when we die? And then to a lesser extent, religions are useful for keeping some social order. Pardon me? Yeah, I wanted to hear that comment on purpose. So they don't. The point is, religions don't always work the way they're intended. It was very common during the Buddhist time, as today, that young men and some young women would leave society and go seek answers to these great questions. And the thought was that if we could somehow figure out those great questions, the mundane issues of our daily life, the disappointment inherent in human life would somehow resolve themselves. That, at least that's kind of the thinking. If we could figure out the big picture, the little picture would take care of itself. The Buddha at the age of 29, Siddhartha Gautama, had the same concerns, but he realized that looking outside of himself, or he quickly realized, I shouldn't say immediately, but he quickly realized that looking outside of himself and seeking answers to the great questions wasn't going to solve his immediate problem, was the nature of suffering. So rather than try to answer the question with a bigger question, where does suffering come from, he sought to directly experience the nature of suffering and the cessation of suffering. That's what he set out to do. And he succeeded. And apparently he's the first one to ever succeed. So upon his awakening, well, keep that into perspective as I'm about to say this. Prior to the Buddha's awakening, he was ignorant of the way things are. Right? Before we know anything, we're ignorant of it. And the reason why I'm trying to soften the word ignorance a little bit, we don't like to admit that we're ignorant, but it's a very general ignorance. It's ignorance of the Four Noble Truths that the Buddha awakened to as the problem. The problem is ignorance of Four Noble Truths, meaning the problem is ignorance of the way things really are. And the problem is ignorance of the way we really are in relation to the world we live in. And when you get back to those big questions, aren't they trying to answer the same thing, but they're looking in the wrong direction, aren't they? In order to understand what's going on here, I have to look here. I have to look where ignorance lies. I can't look out there because the problem isn't ignorance out there. The problem is ignorance within my own mind. I don't understand what's going on. So, the Buddha awakened to the cause of that general disappointment and also included in his awakening is an understanding of the futility in seeking those great answers to those great questions because they can't be answered. And that in itself brings great freedom. We simply stop concerning ourselves with things that are none of our concern. They're just a waste of time. Dependent origination states that from ignorance as a requisite condition comes fabrications. Mental fabrications. Mental fabrications are assumptions we make about ourselves in relation to the world, but in this case, they're rooted in ignorance. And so the understanding that they can provide is itself rooted in ignorance. And anything that's rooted in ignorance has to be disappointing, at the very least, right? If I don't understand something, no matter how fulfilling a situation might be, if I don't understand it, it's not going to be very fulfilling to me because I won't know the proper way to experience it. In fact, if it brings me pleasure, I might want more of it. Because I don't understand phenomena, I might crave for more of it because of the way it makes me feel. Or if it makes me feel upset in some way, because I'm so enamored with myself, I might create an aversion to what's occurring and seek a distraction to avoid this disappointment. Make sense? Following me? This is what we do out of ignorance. We create scenarios that take us out of what's occurring so that we can apply the ignorance that we have to what is occurring and make it fit. Make it fit our views. Make it fit our wrong views. That's the process that ignorance sets in motion, and there's nothing to stop it until wisdom intervenes, until another way of looking at this intervenes. And that's where the Buddha developed and suggested an Eightfold Path. From ignorance as a requisite condition come fabrications. From fabrications as a requisite condition comes consciousness. Now remember, this is not consciousness with a grand C. It's not a grand cosmic consciousness. It's not that kind of consciousness where we're all connected into one grand cosmic being. Even if that's true, that's of no value in developing the Dhamma. It's consciousness with a small C. It's consciousness rooted in ignorance. It's ongoing thinking rooted in ignorance. From fabrications as a requisite condition comes consciousness. From consciousness, from ongoing thinking rooted in ignorance as a requisite condition, comes name and form. The Pali word for name and form is namarupa, and it means just that, name and form. I've given a name to this form, and I'm calling it John. And this is me. It happens to be the most spectacular creature in the world, and you better notice it. And I'm going to spend my entire life defending this thing, because I think I can make it live forever. All rooted in ignorance, isn't it? Instead of understanding, as an awakened human being does, that this thing that I've identified as John, this form, has other components. It has feelings. It creates perceptions and fabrications, and it has a component known as thinking rooted in ignorance. This is five clinging aggregates. How can I create any kind of understanding out of this when my view is so askew as to thinking that this is me? I need another way of looking at things, don't I? I need an eightfold path. I need something that can give me right view. I also need something that will give me understanding of the process that I've engaged in to confuse myself. In other words, I need something that can show me a way to take full responsibility for who I am and the life that I'm having. I need to find a way that won't allow for me to blame anything else or put the focus on anything outside of myself. And that's the Eightfold Path. Frank, you had your hand up?
I did. These 12 links, chain of action, reaction, whatever, it happens with each aggregate, doesn't it? I mean, doesn't it happen at the eye, at the ear?
Oh, yeah, yeah.
At the nose, at the touch, at taste?
Yep.
At each sense it happens?
Not every experience is necessarily experienced through all the senses. But there is an aspect of consciousness, maybe this is what you're asking, but there is an aspect of consciousness associated with each sense.
Yeah.
And that's the important point of that. I'll get into that a little bit further on in this. Does that answer your question?
I mean, right at name and form, this thing called I, me, and mine happens through contact through five physical senses.
Yes. That's how
so each the one self is bundled with feeling, perception, consciousness.
Yes.
Perception.
Yep. The self-reference takes place through the sixth sense base, through the five physical senses and thinking rooted in ignorance, the sixth sense.
But this thing called I, through name and form, rooted in ignorance. I mean,
yes.
It keeps happening, but it didn't.
Oh, it's in a constant... That... An I rooted in ignorance is in a constant process of becoming, just as well as an I who has developed the Eightfold Path and is now rooted in wisdom is in a constant process of becoming. And that really is the only choice we have. Are we going to become awakened in this lifetime or not? As far as the Dhamma is concerned, if you're interested in awakening. If you're not, you know, there's no reason to spend Tuesday nights in Frenchtown here, at least, you know. If you want to awaken, This is what the Buddha taught as a path to awakening, to recognize that it is simply wrong views that create all the suffering in our life, and a way to recognize those wrong views and develop right views. Frank, did you have a follow-up question?
No, I'm just thinking that that's how we all experience the world, what they call the phenomenal world, the material world, the external world. So a mind that's rooted in this eye-making is always going to be in a state of distraction if the focus is outside of the...
Always. And a self-referential, a view rooted in anatta, in a not-self-characteristic, is always focused outside of itself. Even when it's considering itself, that's an external focus because it's objectified its own view of itself. Is that clear?
Mm-hmm.
So every time I'm describing myself to myself, it's in a self-referential and objectified view. Even if it's something as mundane, we're walking through Kohl's and we see a shirt hanging up there. We can't help but look at that shirt in relation to how we think it would look on us. Right? I mean, that's just how we are. There's nothing right or wrong or conditioned about that, except that's a conditioned response. It's just the way we see the world. Again, there's nothing right or wrong about it, but we cannot help but experience the world from that objectified point of view. We can't help but objectify everything because we need to instill anatta into everything that occurs. And that creates a tremendous amount of stress. That is the stress of life. Diane.
You don't have to answer this because I know that it's appropriate. But with understanding which of this non-self, and if a person hurts you or abuses you, and you're a Buddhist and you don't have a self to abuse or hurt,
I'm going to stop you there because I don't mean to interrupt you, but that it's there's nothing in the Buddhist teachings that says that there's no such thing as a self that can be hurt. It's easy to misunderstand, but it's really not a misunderstanding. It's extrapolating the idea that what we think of ourselves does not constitute a self, and the extreme view then, well, if that's not a self, then there's no such thing as a self. I'm exaggerating what you, I'm not, I know you're not
that's
saying
okay.
it this way.
No, that's okay, because I do that.
But we all do that. In fact, I got a response from someone else that was describing how they've gotten past that point, and it's so important to realize that this is not annihilation we're talking about. It is liberation, and that's the words that this person used. He understands that it's liberation, not annihilation. That's where we're going. We're liberating ourselves from something that can only give us and bring us confusion, deluded thinking, and ongoing suffering, ongoing disappointing experience. We're letting go of something that is like foam on the ocean also. There's nothing really there. But as long as we cling to it, as long as we hold on to it, we are prone to confusion, deluded thinking, and ongoing suffering. When we choose to continue to ignore our own ignorance, we are declaring that I do not want to understand Four Noble Truths. I do not want to understand the nature of the world that I live in. So let me go through the rest of these. From consciousness as a requisite condition comes name and form, nama rupa. I'm now identifying myself as this form. From name and form as a requisite condition comes the sixth sense base. Look at the progression here too, and this is important to recognize this. In order for the sixth sense base, for my five physical senses and that thinking rooted in ignorance to continue to distract and confuse me, I have to give it some weight. I have to give it some reality other than the reality that it has. I have to identify with it. I have to give it a name. Once I've given it a name, once I've self-identified as this, then the senses that this has can start identifying the world from that self-referential view. And now whatever occurs is going to be a self-referential experience. Is that clear? So first I'm identifying as name and form, and then I'm using, let me go all the way back to the beginning. I'm ignorant of the way things are. I simply lack an understanding of human life in a general sense. Because of that, and because I've had experiences in life lacking understanding, I've created assumptions about myself in relation to the world based on that ignorance. And those assumptions have led to an ongoing way of thinking that is rooted in that initial ignorance. That ongoing thinking, rooted in ignorance, has now caused me to identify myself as this thing that is developing out of ignorance. Are you all following me?
Can you give an example?
I thought I just did.
No, a real life example. Give a, I mean, like this abuse thing.
Okay. I'll give you a silly one. That is almost related to the truth. When I was 17, my first car was a Ford Falcon. Great little car. But I didn't know anything about auto mechanics. And now I'm just going to exaggerate a lot. So I thought that the best way to change the oil was to take that thing that sits on top of the motor and just get rid of it. Because why is it there anyway? I'm operating out of ignorance. But because I believe that to be true, I took the carburetor off and threw it out. And now I can't figure out why the car won't start. How could this car not start? I did everything I know to make it start, and yet it won't start. It's ignorance. But yet, because I believe that that thing sitting on top of the motor was going to cause me all kinds of trouble and I got rid of it, I still can't understand why this car won't start, and I'm never going to get to start it because I believe that the problem was that thing that I took off. It's rooted in ignorance. Now, I can spend the rest of my life never being able to drive a car because I'm refusing to change my mind. I'm insisting that I'm right, no matter how much trouble it causes me. No matter how many shoes I wear out walking because I can no longer drive, because my mind is simply rooted in ignorance. Now, if I happen to come across an awakened human being, or an auto mechanic, it says, wait a minute. All of your problems and those hundreds of pairs of shoes you've got to buy every year all arise out of that initial ignorance. So here, I'm going to show you what to do, and you put this thing back on, and you do this and you do that, and you check it a little bit every day, and you're going to be good to go. And so now I've learned how to get a car running and operated correctly. Was that a good enough example, Diane?
Well, that's the definition of insanity, doing the same thing over and over again, expecting different results.
So it's also the same. It's also the same as relying on ignorance to provide satisfaction.
Yeah, but I identify with insanity a lot more than I do with ignorance.
Oh.
Sorry.
No, it's okay. Let me get to the end of the becoming origination. All right, I will. Did I answer your question now?
Yes.
Okay. From feeling as a requisite condition comes. I'm sorry, I got to go back. From name and form as a requisite condition comes the sixth sense base. From the sixth sense, again, I should say. Notice that this is not a creation myth either. In some Buddhist schools, it's. Dependent origination is taken as an explanation of creation. And as you can see, there's nothing in here about creating anything. But it often is, that this is a creation myth. And it's describing a three-phase type of physical birth. It's just all nonsense and it never makes any sense. But just to put it in there, because you might hear that. From the sixth sense base, as a requisite condition, comes contact. Makes sense, doesn't it? I have to have something for the world to come in contact with for contact to occur. It's through my senses, right? Through the sixth sense base comes contact. Now, again, keep this in the context. We're not just talking about an ordinary human life and what occurs during that ordinary human life. Remember, we've decided that we want to understand the true nature of reality. And that's the context that this is explained in. And it's the only context that it's useful in. Again, it's not a creation myth. It's not describing any supernatural occurrence. It's simply describing how we created suffering in our own lives through ignorance. Right? From contact as a requisite condition comes feeling. From feeling as a requisite condition comes craving. So again, in that process, and this will be the second time I've said this in this sequence, something has attracted my attention, I've engaged with it, I like it, and now I want more of it. And that is the process of identification and craving and now clinging. And remember, aversion is the same side of the same coin as craving. It's just it's wanting something, wanting to have something, wanting to have less of something is aversion, right? Or not having it at all. From feeling as a requisite condition comes craving. From craving as a requisite condition comes clinging and maintaining. Clinging and maintaining is the same thing. I now have something that I would like to attach myself to. Whether it's I like chocolate cake, or I like that person, or I like certain songs, whatever it might be, or the things that I don't like I start identifying with. Once I've done that, and the process is immediate, now I'm attached. I have to attach myself to it because I've described myself as needing that, as joining with that. When the Buddha talks about suffering, he often describes it as we join with our suffering. And it is in this way that we join with our suffering. We create an identity that can no longer be at peace without having these things in its life.
But you keep going back to it.
Pardon me?
You keep going back to it, though.
Oh, yeah. And that's the essence of clinging. We hold on to it.
Attachment. It's propping up this false...
Exactly. And so everything that originated in ignorance that this has attached itself to is constantly required. In other words, I need to know that all my stuff is safe in order for me... And again, there's the ongoing stress. Of course, we can't maintain anything. In a realistic sense, everything is impermanent. That's getting back to the heart of the matter. So why even bother with it? Frank?
I see that as an important link to understand for yourself. Because then when you get to know that becoming, that wallowing and clinging and attachment, then you get to know your own type of suffering and the first truth. Right?
Yes.
And then understanding where it's coming from can help let it be.
As the Buddha described, right view, awakened right view, is that view understands the nature of suffering. You've penetrated that to such a profound level. And so you simply do not engage in behavior of any kind that is prone to or follows confusion, deluded thinking, and what can only bring disappointment. You simply leave it behind.
So that's why, I think I mentioned this to you before, my entry point into understanding happens at the set what is labeled or numbered the second truth. Through understanding my suffering, then, through clinging, I understand what kind of suffering I'm having, and then through having that right view and understanding and trying to remain in right speech and take the right action, right effort, right mindfulness, then I feel the letting go of the craving, the cessation of...
It's just that way. The experience is just that direct. You know it. This is the practical knowledge that the Buddha talks about. It's experiential knowledge. And so since you've experienced it, you can also explain it. Which is... you do pretty well, Frank. Okay, let me... I'm not going to say another word until I get through dependent information. From clinging and maintaining as a... I'm going to have to say something here, too. From clinging and maintaining as a requisite condition comes becoming. And so it's at this point now that we decide, what am I going to become? Am I going to become liberated? Or do I really hope the next moment brings me more ignorance and the suffering that goes along with that? That's really the choice that I have. Sometimes the choice isn't so clear, but most of the time it is, especially once we have the framework of the Dhamma. We know how to choose and what to choose and how to practice restraint because we have the framework to do that. We know where eye making is occurring most of the time. And if you don't in any particular situation, it doesn't matter because the dis-ease that will follow from it will show you anyway. But you don't need to be so hyper-vigilant. Life itself, framed by the Eightfold Path, will bring awakening. And that really is all that we need to know. Have we developed the Eightfold Path wholeheartedly? Have we integrated into our lives as best as we can? And that's all that we have to do. We only have to do the best we can. And then we get to awaken. We get to leave all this behind us. And it all has to do with what's occurring in this moment. From becoming as a requisite condition comes birth. What am I giving birth to in this moment? And that's the again, we're going to talk more about this in the next couple of weeks. This is an important teaching on karma and rebirth, too. What am I giving birth to in this moment? Because that's the most significant teaching on rebirth ever. Doesn't matter what future life I might be giving birth to. I don't really care. But I do want to know what I'm giving birth to in the next moment, because that's something that I have control over in the sense that I can determine the type of life that I live by what I put into it, meaning what I hold in mind, the type of mindfulness. From becoming as a requisite condition come birth. From birth as a requisite condition come sickness, death, sorrow, regret, pain, distress, and despair. Now, here the Buddha's talking about, again, remember where he began this, from ignorance as a requisite condition. Now, 11 links later, from that initial ignorance comes giving birth to sickness, death, aging, regret, sorrow, distress, despair, from that initial ignorance. But the converse is also true. From wisdom as a requisite condition comes liberation, from the cessation of ignorance. Then the Buddha describes in slightly more detail and in reverse order the 12 links. Now, what is aging and death? Aging is decrepitude, brokenness, graying, decline, weakening of faculties.
It is.
Death is the passing away of the five clinging aggregates, the ending of time, the interruption of life faculties. And what is birth? Birth is the descent, the coming forth, the coming to be. Birth is the appearance of the six sense bases and the five clinging aggregates. Again, keep it in context. We're not talking about a physical birth. We're talking about giving birth to that which is prone to suffering. Now, what is becoming? Becoming is sensual becoming. Becoming is form becoming and formless becoming. Formless becoming is the, in reference here, is the belief in a soul that lives forever as the same entity. And what is clinging and maintaining? There are four types of clinging. Clinging to sensory stimulus, clinging to views, wrong views, or conditioned thinking. Clinging to precepts and practices, meaning rituals that we think we need to do to improve ourselves, or in the context of a religion, rituals that I need to do to deliver myself to a higher power, or to a heaven state or something like that. And clinging to a doctrine of self. Of course, that's the ultimate ignorance, is clinging to a doctrine of self. And that's what has developed since the Buddha's time and even before the Buddha's time. All of it is a doctrine of self. How can I maintain this? How can I continue to ignore my own ignorance? Those are doctrines of self. And what is craving? There are six classes of craving. Craving for forms, craving for feelings, craving for sounds, craving for smells, craving for tastes, and craving for physical sensations, and craving for ideas. Everything that is fed through the sixth sense base and ongoing thinking.
Just what you were talking about.
And it comes through every one of the sense organs is said by the Buddha to have its own type of consciousness, meaning that my eye consciousness is perceiving things that I'm seeing through that consciousness that is rooted in ignorance. That's the important thing to remember about that, the sensory consciousness. It's perceiving things through that initial ignorance. And so anything that follows from that perception only supports that ignorance. Is everybody following me so far? Is it clear where I'm going with this? Where? Somebody tell me.
Awakening. To why we need the Eightfold Path.
Why?
To help us escape this loop that we get ourselves into, so that we ultimately awaken.
Does everybody understand that? Mm-hmm. Okay. Then. I was going to say, let me just go a little bit further. And what is feeling? Feeling has six classes as well. Feeling arises from contact. From the sixth sense context. I won't go through all those. And what is contact? Phenomenon, contacting the eye, the ear, the nose, the tongue, the body, and the intellect. This is contact with the sixth sense base. And what is name and form? Feeling, perceptions, intention, attention, and contact. Name and form, all things that the body possesses. Discriminating consciousness is name. The elements of water, fire, earth, and wind, that which makes up physical forms is called forms. Name and form is discriminating consciousness bound to or clinging to physical form. And the point of all that is everything that we've just talked about is all impermanent. There's nothing of any substance here. All of the things that are identified as constituting not self can be seen as always in a constant process of becoming. And we're in control of that becoming based on what we're holding in mind. We're in control of that becoming based on what we hold in mind. If we hold in mind the principles of the Eightfold Path, we will become awakened, we'll have lives of lasting peace and happiness. If we hold in mind those things that we've developed out of ignorance and insist have value, we'll only continue to have experiences rooted in ignorance. And is that clear? Is that really clear? That we have to act out of a place of understanding and knowledge if we expect to have a life that is rooted in those types of experiences? It just makes sense, doesn't it? That's exactly what the Buddha awakened to, and it's very simple. And it makes sense, too, that there's some effort in gaining knowledge, isn't it? But it's not impossible effort. We've all done that in our life. We've all learned things. Now there's one last thing left to learn. Reality. Who am I in relation to the world? And we have a simple and direct way of doing that. An Eightfold Path that anybody can do. I want to read the Loka Sutta before I finish. You're all reading the chapter too because I'm leaving some stuff out, but it's important. Mm-hmm. You're reading the background on this? Okay. I just want to touch on the Loka Sutta here because it relates so well to what we're doing. And this is in that, those of you that have read it, the section on becoming. There's three different suttas in there in the book Becoming Buddha, and we went over this on our retreat. And this is the first sutta, if I can find it. The reason why this is significant is the Buddha is describing, he's looking out in the world when he's first awakened. But he's describing the ongoing process that we find ourselves in and that we're hoping to extricate ourselves from, meaning stuck in wrong views. The newly awakened Siddhartha, now a Buddha, was enjoying the peace of release. Established in concentration, he observed the world around him. He noticed human beings aflame with the fires born of the defilements of passion, aversion, and deluded consciousness. Those that were on retreat last year and the other retreats, the Saturday talk is always on the fire discourse. So you remember that, the Anatta Lakkhana Sutta. Realizing the significance of what he was seeing, the Buddha thought, the world is a flame. Rooted in ignorance, the world is afflicted by sensory contact. It's not afflicted by sensory contact, period, because the world is rooted in ignorance, it's afflicted by sensory contact. Ignorance is required for that suffering. Rooted in ignorance, rooted in ignorance, the world is afflicted by sensory contact and perceives suffering as self, or joining with that suffering. Rooted in ignorance, it misunderstands self and becomes anything other than self. That last line was, it's a little bit hard to understand until you put it in context. Because we don't understand what constitutes a self, from that moment of ignorance, we spend now eons becoming anything other than self. How could we become a self if we're ignorant of what a self is? We have no choice. We have no framework. We have no path. Does everybody understand that? How could we become anything other than ignorant if we don't have a way to show us our own ignorance? That's what that line means. Becoming anything other than self. Becoming anything other than self, the world clings to becoming. Now that I've become something other than what is rooted in reality, I'm clinging to that becoming. And that now that you can see that the process is set in motion, the process of becoming. Becoming anything other than self, the world clings to becoming, is afflicted by that very becoming. And yet delights in that very becoming. Where there is delight, there is fear. That's the Buddha's describing the nature of stress. Where there is delight in self-establishment in an impermanent environment, there has to be fear. Why? Because that self knows at a deep and profound level that it can't do what it's trying to do, maintain a permanent self, because all things are impermanent.
And it knows that that delight will end.
Yes. And so now think about it. I've now created in my mind, rooted in ignorance, great delight in having this be me. But I don't understand me. And I can't figure out how I can keep me forever. Now there's stress. And that's stress. Because now I've decided that this is me, this is all that I am, this is all that I'll ever be. And because of those foolish decisions, I now am compelled to maintain this that can't be maintained. Initiated and rooted in those wrong views. So what can I do? Again, develop the Eightfold Path and realize that it's just views of myself that are wrong views. There's nothing there. Frank, you had a question.
I was just reflecting on relationships with others.
How so?
Trying to create a permanent relationship with another person. Things are always changing.
Yeah, and we do that all the time, don't we? We expect our relationships to be permanent too. And you can't have a human life and not know impermanence, but you want to ignore it. We don't want to know that our everything is impermanent. Our important those that we love, they're all impermanent. Everything.
But a relationship doesn't have to be impermanent. Your expectations of what it's going to be like every minute is what's impermanent.
Then not self-characteristics, right, I feel, like, are impermanent.
Yeah. Well, but like accepting that things will change.
Oh, yeah.
And everything's, I mean, that's part of it, but it doesn't mean, it just means that it's in constant motion. It's dynamic.
Yep.
Everything is dynamic.
Yeah.
Expecting things to stay the same, that's your non-reality.
Yeah.
But
yeah,
accepting that things will change, just like the river, you can't step in the same river twice, but there's still a river.
Yep.
So things can go on, just don't expect it to be the same all the time.
Yeah. And if you can accept that in your relationships, they're wonderful relationships, aren't they? Mm-hmm. Because then you're literally contributing to each other's growth because you accept it. Mm-hmm. The reason and I'm not going to go into that story. There are situations that a partner, a spouse, can be threatened by what the other person is doing, especially if it excludes them, because they feel like they're going to get left behind. This happens sometimes even here. So when you can have those communication, those levels of communication, and there's no competition,
mm-hmm.
you know. So you're right. I mean, a relationship isn't permanent or impermanent, except it is. I mean, the person we're in relationship with has an impermanent form. And so there is that aspect of it. But if we can, when we truly understand that we are in a constant process of becoming, and we bring that into our relationships with others, it's very empowering to others. Because we're not holding them back either. And we're an example of that, of being in a constant process. I mean, I think that's why when people saw the Buddha walking down the road and went chasing after him, it's because he held himself that way. You know, he had that air about him. You know, it was, you could see liberation in him because of the way he carried himself. It's a good point, Helen. We're in this 3 or 4 weeks now in the three marks of existence, and that point, the reason why I'm bringing it up, it points directly to the impermanence of all things. When we really get that, we get everything. Because we'll stop trying to create anything in a permanent nature, because we understand everything is impermanent. Thanks, Ellen. The Buddha continues, "The life integrated with the Eightfold Path is lived for the abandoning of becoming further ignorant." That last two words are mine, becoming further ignorant. The Buddha's words for the abandoning of becoming. "Those that say that escape from becoming is by non-becoming are never released from becoming, I declare. Stress or dukkha arises in dependence on becoming self. With the ending of clinging to self and maintaining self, no stress will arise. Simply letting it go. Look at the world. Human beings afflicted with ignorance crave and cling to becoming further ignorant. All forms of becoming anywhere, in any way, are impermanent, stressful, and always subject to change. Knowing this, the arising and passing away, from right view, craving for becoming and non-becoming is abandoned. It simply has a consequence of developing the Dhamma. From the abandonment of craving for becoming and non-becoming comes unbinding. Once we let go the craving, we're no longer clinging to it. For those unbound from lack of clinging and maintaining, there is no further becoming. Keep it in contact, no more further becoming ignorant. They have conquered ignorance, completed the task, and have gone beyond ignorance. They have gone beyond a self rooted in ignorance. That's the end of the Loka Sutta. I think we'll probably get into the other two suttas next week, too, as we go along. Any questions about this, where we went today, maybe over the last 3 weeks of the course? Does anybody have any questions about this, the idea of eye-making, and that's the central problem, or eye-making rooted in ignorance? Okay, now maybe you could talk a little bit as you go around the room if you understand that as the problem, and in relation to the three marks of existence. Ram, good to see you.
Good to see you. I'm still working on bringing that part, the eye-making, into when I look at distraction. But the distractions are getting to be really clear in my life, and how the different distractions kind of seamlessly flip from one to the other, how you can go from lust to anger and to neutral and vice versa.
Yeah.
But I'm still distilling out how the eye-making part looks. And it's just going to take more looking at what's going on.
Do you mean how distraction facilitates further eye-making?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, I've heard it 100 times, but as far as actually living that experience,
it really is the reason why there's an Eightfold Path. Because what you're talking about is the nature of deluded thinking.
Yeah.
You know, and how do I? So the reason why distraction works so well to continue eye making is that it allows for just that, for the continuing of ignorance.
Mm.
Any strategy used for distraction is a strategy used to ignore ignorance, no matter what it is.
To ignore the true nature.
Yes, and so we create incredibly powerful, realistic, meaningful, seemingly valuable things, objects,
right,
to block us from recognizing reality, to act as distractions. And you could say, giving into distraction is giving into eye making,
mm-hmm,
because it's required.
Fantastic.
Yeah, does that help you at all?
No, it's just another prod in the right direction.
Yeah, it is. I mean, it's the Buddha could have nearly accurately had described the First Noble Truth as saying there is distraction, as saying there is dukkha,
mm-hmm,
because it's the ongoing preoccupation with dukkha, with stress, that distracts us from our lives. It's an important, thank you. Andrew, good to see you.
That's a simplistic question. How can, I don't understand how eye making on any level can be avoided. I mean, just saying I'm hungry, I'm thirsty, it's cold, I need to swear.
What?
I'm substantiating my needs.
It's a good point. So there's a middle way, and that's what you bring up such a good point, Andrew. The Buddha described the Eightfold Path as the middle way between extreme views, between the views of complete self-denial and complete sensory indulgence. A human being lives most successfully in the middle of those extremes. And so a human being has some practical needs. One is for food. And one of the ways that we know we should get food is we get hungry. A person, an awakened human being, when they're hungry, let me use the Buddha as an example, will get up from his, wherever he's sitting in the forest, and walk into town with a bowl and get a bowl of food. And he'll get maybe a couple of beans and maybe a little bit of rice, and he'll thank the person, walk back, and eat that. An unawakened person is going to walk into town with a bowl and a plate and a big bag and maybe a giant spoon. And they're given some rice, they're given some beans, they're given a nice head of lettuce and a little bowl of soup, and they say, where's the steak? It's in the eye-making that it's in the where's the steak that the eye-making is. Do you see the difference? It's I'm not satisfied with what's in front of me. I need something different. So the situation is the same. We need food. We need clothing. The Buddha said every human being needs four things. We need food, clothing, shelter, and medicine. Partaking of those is not eye-making. Eye-making is something that is rooted in ignorance of Four Noble Truths. Living in the world is not eye-making. Living in the world from ignorance or establishing ignorance is eye-making. The scene is the same. The setting is the same. What is your thinking like? What are you holding in mind? So again, the same... You can take that scenario of needing food to anything. It could be that we're never happy with the new car we get every year. We're always thinking about the next one. Eye-making is in the mind. It's not about what we're interacting with. It's how we're interacting with it. So there's no eye-making with eating a bowl of rice unless you bring eye-making to it. There's no eye-making with getting dressed in the morning unless you bring eye-making to it. There's no eye-making with going to work and doing your job unless you bring eye-making into it. Is that clear?
There's also in just the language that you use for yourself, there's the eye making. It's I'm hot, or damn, I'm hot. Like if you skip that part and just realize you're hot, you open the window. At that point, there's no suffering. If your mind goes, Jesus, it's hot in here. There's a suffering.
By wanting it to be different.
If it is, John, could you turn up the air conditioning for a second? There's no suffering. Because you've taken your own dissatisfaction out of the exchange.
Mm-hmm. Another way of saying it is...
Same thing goes for being hungry and cold and whatever. If you stop using it as your personal experience and therefore your personal suffering, then
that's the important word here, taking things personal, because there's nothing personal. There's nothing that we can describe as truly personal in the world except that we make it so. We take ownership of it. It does take a little bit of time to really penetrate this. This is the heart of the matter. What is exactly I making? How do I do it? It's by self-referencing everything.
The personal, someone comes up to you and tells you you're a dirty, rotten rat, mm-hmm. and you're ugly, mm-hmm. What do?
And your mother dresses you funny.
What?
And your mother dresses
you. Well, I think you don't take it personal because anybody that's talking to you like that, you don't need to take it personal.
Yeah, basically the response is thank you for sharing that with me.
Pardon me?
So the response is to be thank you for sharing that with me. And you may even want to say I don't agree with that.
Or is there a possibility that because what I hear is that part of what breaks the chain of getting stuck is recognizing what arises.
Mm-hmm.
It's what I do with what arises as I apply the Eightfold Path. So if I'm maybe, when somebody says something in that to me. At least this is how I kind of want work to apply it, is that I feel sad or I feel upset. Why did the stranger say this to me? But when I acknowledge it, then I can have the spaciousness to be able to think about what's the right thing for me to, what's the skillful thing for me to say, as opposed to, you know, reacting first to protect them. So in a way, I mean, and this is how I always think, everything is so damn connected to the next thing. If the next thing that brings me back to that, how I perceive the self as being hungry in doing things skillfully, as opposed, I don't know, I'm in the middle of a knot. So
well, the Eightfold Path is the path to awakening. It's what we use to reframe our thinking from an ongoing ignorant view of the world to a view that is rooted in reality. And along the way, as we develop the Dhamma, we naturally stop taking anything personal, because we realize that it is. It's not something that you take because I said it. It's, you know, we shouldn't take things personal. You have the actual experience of living life without the need to react to it. And then you realize what incredible liberation there is in not reacting and not taking. I mean, you have to have the experience of not taking things personal to understand how valuable it is to not take things personal. Frank, you had your hand up. I'm sorry, Bonnie. But,
me?
Yeah,
I have for a couple different things, but Ron kind of said it anyway. It was about the eye making. I feel you can feel cold when you take it personal. That's where your mind, you know, your You don't have a mind that's inclined to abandoning, craving, and clinging. It's a mind that's not being mindful of the Eightfold Path. I don't see the path as a way to escape things in life. I find it as a way of a middle way through the experience of life.
Yeah, it's just life.
Way. It leads us back to rebirth again.
Yeah.
And,
when the Buddha described the First Noble Truth, he said, dukkha occurs. As a consequence of having a human life, there's going to be stress. There's no way to avoid it. Why is that the noble truth? Why is that the first thing that an awakened human being had to say? Because we don't want to pay attention to it. We want to make believe that, no, there isn't stress, and I can create a permanent and happy and ongoing happy ongoing existence for myself no matter what occurs. It can't be done. Or I can grow up and stop taking things so personal, which is really what that means. That's why I describe awakening as full human maturity. I don't always have to get what I want. In fact, if I want to be happy, I don't want to ever get what I want. I just want to be happy.
I don't always see myself as...
Let me call it, because if I spend my life chasing after things that I think I need to be happy, I'm never going to be happy. Because you can never fill up, you know, the red wagon. It just gets bigger and bigger and bigger.
The point is that
when the Buddha awakened and he looked out on the world and he said the world is a flame, he's describing desire. He's describing taking things personally. Rather than looking out on the world and saying there's nothing there to be personal. Yeah. And the other thing about what you brought up, Andrew, is that, I said it a few times, is we don't have to take anything personal. We know we have to eat, you know? So go eat. And if I don't happen to get what I expected to get, that's fine, you know. If I don't get the warmest coat or the biggest house or the nicest spot along the beach, it doesn't really matter. Because that's an ego that says, but I know that every day I wake up and I'm on this side of the dirt, I'm going to have a couple of meals or at least one. I'm going to need to put some clothes on my body once in a while. You don't want to see me without clothes. And I gotta pay the bills. You know, those are things that I have to do. But I don't have to take it personal when I do it. Mm-hmm. And if I can only afford hamburger this week, I can't get steaks. So what?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, am I gonna
lose a week thinking about, boy, next week I can get out of the hamburger rut and get steaks?
Mm-hmm.
there's the eye making. Rather than just, or have a nice potato. Doesn't have to have
people that are most, it
doesn't have to cost an animal.
Those that have to be in control of everything.
Yeah.
That's the root of their unhappiness.
So, Andrew, you bring up such an important point, and that it really, again, just comes back to taking things personal.
Yeah.
So we don't, and that theme of annihilation comes up so often in slightly different ways. Sometimes we look at it a little differently, but that's where it goes. You know, what happens when I let go of all desire? You're free. Yeah. Thank you. Helen, good to see you.
Good to see you too, John. How are you?
I'm good. Thank you for asking.
Glad to hear that. The way I look at it a lot of times is just managing your expectations and also just listening. Like if you're driving in a car and someone pulls out in front of you and you start saying anything, it doesn't change the situation. They can't hear that you're upset. You're just holding on to that. Something you said earlier, you know, that holding on to sort of, you cling to that, you know, I deserve to be angry. Look what they just did to me. So it's, you know, if you see someone that looks like they're going to pull out, might as well expect that they're going to pull out. Okay. Then there they are, and there you are, and you're just going along your merry way. So I think a lot of it is just, you know, managing your expectations, and if you start to realize you're expecting something to be different than it is, why did you do that to me? You know, why did that happen? You're asking the wrong question.
Yeah.
And just, you know, we have this thing about, you know, if you're in a line and you're like, ah, oh, got all these people, I'm behind. It's like, well, how often can you just stand there and just have a peaceful moment? You don't have to move any faster than you are. You're not going to move any faster than you are. So just enjoy that moment you've just been given. And so I think that applies to so many things in life. It's just managing our expectations. When you come up against something that didn't turn out the way you thought it would, okay, you know, look at it, understand it. If you have a way to make things happen different in the next moment, go for it.
Yeah.
You know, just, yeah, so it's come down to just don't take it personally.
Yeah.
It's not happening to you, it's just happening.
It's just happening, it's part of life. Duke occurs. Thank you, Helen. Frank, before you go, what do you have to say?
Everybody drive safe.
You too.
Yeah, no, I guess about dependent arising. What do I have to say about it? I guess for me, when I'm in it and I can feel it, I already know that I have a mind that's inclined towards ignorance and mindlessness. And instead of fighting against the stream to get back to it, I try to cultivate spiritual principles of surrender and acceptance and generosity and compassion. You know, like somebody slights me in a way with a vicious tongue or whatever, I don't think that what I've been studying and trying to learn is, I'm not doing it so that I can learn someone else's ignorance. I think that when I learn about my own ignorance, I understand other people's ignorance so much better, and it doesn't bother me. I don't take it personal. So it's in the cultivation of those qualities, spiritual principles, that helps me not allow dependent origination take a foothold.
Beautiful. Thank you.
Have a good night.
You too. Get home safe. Greg, good to see you.
Good to see you, John. Yeah, I think this is one of the most misunderstood and misconveyed aspects of Buddhism.
Yep.
I guess right next to karma, being you do good things and good things will happen to you. And then even people that you feel are very knowledgeable and you see it conveyed. I remember, you know, when you first, like, introduction to Buddhism type things, karma is you do good things and good things happen, you do bad things and bad things will happen, and there's no self So, you know, then it turns into this nihilistic, nothing you do matters,
yeah.
And, you know, just don't care about anything, Buddhists, just this strange, you know, like juvenile kind of incomprehensible philosophy
word.
That doesn't really apply to anything.
Mm-hmm.
And I think if more people understood it, because it's probably one of the biggest charges against Buddhism, especially people trying to mock you personally, which is funny because ego, but when you get into trying to explain these things and people say things like, oh, well, you know, there's no self, you don't mind what I do to you, right? You don't mind if I hurt you, you don't mind. But there's just simple practicality. Of course I mind. You know, if there's the ultimate reality and then there's the practicality. There's the ways of talking about things and understanding their true nature of, you know, tree under property, your neighbor wants to cut it down. They're not going to come over and say, oh, well, there is no tree. It's just a complex organization of, you know, molecules and atoms and quarks and gluons, whatever. And essentially, if you really look close enough, there's nothing there. So, oh, okay, cut it down. Like, it doesn't change the fact, like, that, whatever, I like the tree. You know?
Yeah.
I don't know, maybe I proved the opposite point because I'm attaching to the tree, but I don't know. There's the practical, I'm cold, I'm essentially saying, if you understand what the I is, you're saying, you know, there is this experience happening through the sense doors of cold, there's a discomfort arising from, you know, all these different, and you understand what's going on, how it's happening. So we're limited by language, of course, how we convey what we're feeling, and we have this first-person perspective. And that's how it's going to be until we're gone,
mm-hmm.
as far as I can tell. And that's the end of that train of thought.
Thank you, Greg.
Sometimes I just fall and see where they're going.
Thanks. Mary, good to see you tonight.
Good to be here, John. Good to see everyone. I like what we've been talking about, the neutrality. We really got into some stuff there, and ambivalence and indifference, and, you know, just concepts I hadn't thought about before. I think there's so much in the space of ego and the not-self. You know, it's just in everything, you know, and we've talked before about even hearing it in your words. This relates to what Andrew was saying, you know, whether your words are in the future or the past, you know that you're potentially off the path and not present with your life unfolding right in front of you. You know, it's just going to take a lot of work. Like, there's still certain times, like I remember when I realized that any time I was feeling I'm justified in having this feeling. I remember learning, like, okay, there's a problem. Like, there's eye making. There's a problem, right? But I still do it, you know, that I feel something and I feel the arising, but I feel very justified in what I'm stewing in. And try as I might, may not pull myself out of it right away. But I'm aware of it. I'm aware of it, you know. Just keep saying, okay, I'm still aware of it. Still aware of it.
Half credit.
Still there. Not letting it go yet. You know, I think this topic, you know, deserves many weeks because it is so, you know, it's pervasive. And what we were talking about last week with the indifference and the ambivalence and all that, that was starting to get to a whole nother layer of subtlety and nuance about how the self can present itself. And it goes back to all those strategies that you develop to, whether it's you think you're protecting yourself or whatever it is you're doing based on how you're brought up or whatever situation you feel you're in, you know, you're taking yourself completely off the path. And the more we can recognize, I feel like I'm just stating the obvious, but the more you can recognize it, the more you can just be with it, begin to think about how you're going to renunciate and get back to being present. So, you know, still on the path, you know, making an ardent effort to stay on the path in most areas of my life, so... That's all. Oh, and one more thing to say.
Please?
Happy birthday, Liz.
Happy birthday, Liz.
Oh, Liz, happy birthday.
But thank you.
Thank you. And thank you for stating the obvious. I mean, the Dhamma is obvious, you know, and it's important to state that repeatedly. It's right there in front of us. You know, you just don't want to see it.
Yeah.
Thank you. David, good to see you tonight. How are you?
You spend, in my case, 57 years of heavy lifting, of bashing this life, you know, tearing down your rivals, building up yourself, and it's heavy lifting, it's heavy work. And through this practice, I've only been doing it 8 months, but I've found that there's a lightness and a focus, being able to stay very present. And that's what you want.
Yep.
You don't want to be to the right or the left. You want to be in this sweet spot.
Yep.
You know, it's like a golfer hitting that golf ball.
Yeah.
In this case, being able to see that what you've made is not real, and it's impermanent. I wish this was taught, you know, when you were 10.
Yeah.
It would save a lot of
problems. I agree. Thank you, David. Yeah. They do need to teach this in schools. Russ, good to see you tonight. How are you?
Good, thank you. I guess what I think about when I think about eye-making is to spend a lot of time saying things like, I deserve this or that. Why not me? Mm-hmm. Or I didn't deserve that. Why me?
Yeah.
Spend a lot of time with that.
Yeah.
It's a waste of time because you're not, you know, it is what it is.
Yeah.
You're not that special. You know, me, that I deserve that over, you know. And so, you know, and you spend a lifetime saying, I deserve better.
Yeah.
I deserve more. And it's a big waste of time. So that's kind of how I see the eye making.
That's it, Russ.
Not very fruitful.
Yeah, it is. It's the cause of stress. It's a cause of suffering. I'm making. It's just that simple, too. Thank you. Diane, good to see you tonight. How are you?
Good. How are you?
Good.
I'm seeing poor me, pity pots, and blame, or I'm making kind of things.
Yes.
That's it.
Gold star. Bonnie, good to see you.
Good to see you, too. Sometimes I get it. Sometimes I don't want to get it. And I think I struggle mostly with how to help sometimes when I'm working. I guess just have to get myself out of the way and be able to sit with people, because the other thing I think that is I'm making is if I've discovered something, it doesn't mean that anyone else around me is going to or has to be in that same place. And so I think also being clear where I sit too helps me to sit with others. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does. So, I think you're talking about the occasional difficulties in just staying focused on the Dhamma and not get, you know, kind of pulled away by just life as life occurs.
And in whether it's in personal or it's in work,
mm-hmm.
related to me.
Yeah. And just to remember that it's all impersonal, you know. Like the Buddha says, when we find ourselves getting agitated in any way or excited, to remind ourselves, this is not me, this is not mine, this is not who I am. And then you can really enjoy what's going on because you don't need more of it. Be at peace with it. So, good class. Thank you. Any other questions about this? I mean, the core idea of impermanence and not-self. We're going to spend a little more time on it again next week in the five clinging aggregates and probably a week after that. And then when we're done with the course, we'll spend a couple of weeks on this idea of indifference and ambivalence. All right, let's we'll finish with metta, like we always do. So find your relaxed meditative posture, gently close your eyes and gently close your mouths. And take a moment to become mindful of the sensation of breathing in your body, of your in-breath and your out-breath. And these are the Buddha's words on metta from the Karaniya Metta Sutta. This is what should be done by one who is skilled in goodness and who knows the path of peace. Let them be able and upright, straightforward and gentle in speech, humble and not conceited, contented and easily satisfied. Unburdened with duties and frugal in their ways, peaceful and calm and wise and skillful, not proud or demanding in nature. Let them not do the slightest thing that the wise would later reprove. Wishing in gladness and in safety, may all beings be at ease. Whatever living beings there may be, whether they are weak or strong, omitting none, the great or the mighty, medium, short, or small, the seen and the unseen, those living near and far away, those born and to be born, may all beings be at ease. Let none deceive another or despise any being in any state. Let none through anger or ill will wish harm upon another. Even as a mother protects with her life her child, her only child, so with a boundless heart should one cherish all living beings. Radiating kindness over the entire world, spreading upwards to the skies and downwards to the depths, outwards and unbounded, freed from hatred and ill will. Whether standing or walking, seated or lying down, free from drowsiness, one should sustain this recollection. This is said to be the sublime abiding. By not holding to fixed views, the pure-hearted one, having clarity of vision and being freed from all sense desires, is not born again into this world. Thank you all for a wonderful class. Peace.
Peace. Thank you, John.
Thank you for listening. I rely on donations to support these talks. If you find benefit from these talks, please consider a donation at becoming-buddha.com. I welcome your questions and comments. To contact me and for guided meditations and instructions, Dhamma articles, recorded talks, and videos, please visit becoming-buddha.com. These talks are copyrighted and are distributed under a Creative Commons License 4.0. Peace.